What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Welcome, everyone, to today's Barron's Live Market Watch edition. I am Rob Schroeder, and I'm the DC Bureau Chief for Market Watch. And today, I'm delighted to welcome our two guests to talk about the outlook for the midterm elections and what the outcome might mean for the economy and your money. So today I'm joined by Ben Colton, who is the Director of Research at Beacon Policy Advisors in Washington, and Professor Melissa Miller, who is an expert on politics at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. Ben, Melissa, welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So, Melissa, I'd like to start with you, and I want to throw out a couple of numbers. First, the betting market predicted is giving Republicans currently a 76% chance of taking the Senate in the midterms. And for the House, it's even higher, 87% at last check. Why is it looking so good for the GOP?
Well, it's always the case that the president's party virtually always loses seats in the midterm elections. So there's an historical precedent. The incumbent president's party almost always loses seats in the midterms. If you go back to World War II and look at the average seats lost by the incumbent president's party in the House, it's 26 seats on average lost by the party of the president. And in the Senate, it's 4 seats on average. So the Republicans in 2022 don't even have to approach those averages to retake control of the House, where they just need a net gain of 5 seats, or the Senate, where they need a net gain of 1 seat. So historical precedent is on the side of the Republicans. Then you combine that with the really low approval rating of President Joe Biden. It's at just 41% now. And you can see why the history and the president's approval rating both point to big Republican gains. Mm-hmm. Now, to put this in perspective, at this point in Barack Obama's first term, he had higher approval. It was 48-49%, and yet he took what he called a shellacking, losing 63 seats in the House in 2010 and 6 in the Senate. So really, things do not look good for the Democrats. And I haven't even talked about the fact that redistricting post-2020 census really has helped strengthen the Republicans' position, as well as the surging inflation rate, which certainly helps the Republicans.
Right, that's a good segue to what I want to ask Ben about next. Ben, I wanted to drill down on the economic environment. President Biden recently called inflation his top domestic priority. And he's taken steps to ease prices on things like gasoline by releasing oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Of course, Democrats control Congress and lawmakers have approved billions of dollars in economic aid since the pandemic began. So why aren't Democrats getting more credit?
Well, Biden and Democrats, they're not just dealing with a crisis of inflation. They're also dealing with a crisis of confidence. And that harkens back to another president who was struggling with inflation back in the 70s when President Carter, he gave his infamous crisis of confidence speech. And he recounted how a governor told him he was not leading the nation, he was just managing the government. And that's just an all too common sentiment shared about the president today. Joe Biden is seen as managing a declining nation rather than leading a promising one. And it goes against what Biden was elected as a modest and a moderate person to bring a return to normalcy after a once in a century pandemic and a once in a lifetime reality TV president. But that return to normalcy Biden promised was just, it hasn't come to fruition. Even before inflation became front and center, there was the rise of the Delta variant, and there was the bungled withdrawal from Afghanistan. And now with once-in-a-generation inflation, there's low voter and consumer sentiment today that matched the sentiment during Carter's presidency. American optimism about their personal finances is on the decline, and distrust of institutions of power is high. And so everything remains not normal in the minds of Americans. And they're just not interested or responsive to listening to Biden or Democrats explain what they have accomplished so far. It just goes to the Washington adage, if you're explaining, you're losing. And right now, just Democrats are losing the message.
Melissa, can you help us understand how voters are approaching the midterms? We've heard from Ben about what the Democrats are trying to do in Congress, what the president's trying to do. But when you look at voter behavior, what's top of mind right now? Is it inflation, a possible recession, abortion rights, crime? What do you think is driving the midterms this time around?
Well, let me start by saying what always drives the midterms or in virtually every midterm election, and that's pocketbook issues. The economy really is a driver of vote choice, and that's based on decades of political science research. Occasionally, there will be an exception. The 2002 midterms immediately after 9/11 were about national security. But for the most part, voters vote based on these pocketbook issues. Fortunately, Gallup is a great source for what's on the top of minds of voters. Every month, they ask a random sample of adult Americans, what's the most important problem facing the United States? And they let voters just volunteer what's on their mind. What we've seen is since January, a 19 percentage point increase in respondents saying the economy or economic issues. That's a big increase. Now, what's driving it? Well, those respondents are saying a lot of things, right? Some are saying wages, but what's really driving that 19% increase is a surge in people mentioning inflation generally, and a surge in people mentioning gas and fuel prices. So I think that 2022 will not be an exception. I think the economy and pocketbook issues will drive voters. There's one caveat, and that is what appears to be the imminent overturning of Roe versus Wade. We could see that drives a big Democratic surge when women's rights to abortion are overturned, as all indications are they will be in June or July.
Okay, Ben, we're here to talk about the midterms, of course, but there's a lot there in what Melissa said that we can chew on. Even right now, there's about a half year to go until the midterms. With Democrats still in control of Congress, do you think they can get anything across the finish line that may bolster their chances? Can they do anything, for example, to help tame inflation?
Now, if there was a politically palatable policy Democrats could employ to tame inflation, they would have done it yesterday. But there isn't. I mean, real deflationary policy would require taming consumer demand, and no politician wants to be accountable for that. So when it comes to taming inflation, the center is not Capitol Hill or the White House. It's a couple blocks away from the White House at the Federal Reserve. But the key for Democrats is to rejigger their long-held policy priorities for the current moment. This is not just for voters, but for the other President Joe, a.k.a. Senator Joe Manchin. So that means calling Build Back Better, their reconciliation plan, not transformational, but deflationary and deficit reducing. It means calling executive action on student debt forgiveness inflation relief. And it means calling China competitiveness legislation something that's shoring up supply chains and supply side imbalances. Now, will any of these measures tame inflation in the near term? No. I mean, student debt forgiveness is actually inflationary. But I believe Democrats, they do have some success in all three areas before the midterms. And so for reconciliation, there's a universe of say, $1 to $1.5 trillion in offsets, whether that's Medicare drug pricing reform or tax increases on corporations on the wealthy that can get Manchin and Senator Kyrsten Sinema's support. And this would be supplemented with, say, some clean energy tax incentives and possibly bolstering the Affordable Care Act. And then both parties see an advantage in trying to get China competitiveness legislation passed before the August recess. And that includes about $50 billion for semiconductors. And then Biden has been setting the tone for a means-tested student debt relief, something in the $10,000 range. And that could an announcement could come in the coming weeks before the current moratorium on payments lapses. I don't see any of these actions as taming inflation or really the general anti-democratic midterm environment. But it is a good narrative for Democrats to have, if not in 2022, then as the policies get implemented and felt by kind of the broader electorate come 2024.
Thanks, Ben. At this point, I'd like to remind folks who are watching that you can send in questions, and Ben or Melissa or I will try to answer them and discuss them. I do see that we have a few coming in already, and a viewer named Max is asking about stagflation and the consequences of that. Now, that is a word that has popped up sort of in the political discourse recently. So Melissa or Ben, is that something that you two have heard about or voters are talking about and see as something that's on the horizon here? Or has that not popped up too much, that kind of worry?
I haven't seen it much. I'm gonna defer to Ben on this. My view is inflation is on the minds of all voters, and that's because every time they go to the grocery store, make any purchase, whether it's online or at a brick and mortar place, they put fuel in the gas tank, they are thinking inflation.
Yeah, well, we heard Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen mention the possibility of stagflation. And it certainly, that's the concern is that, you know, the Federal Reserve, that they're trying to do this soft landing of increasing rates and bringing down inflation without causing the economy to go into a recession. And the track record is not great. But there is some, you know, strong demand and strong balance sheets from consumers. But it kind of gets back to the point is, do Democrats, you know, in their hopes of having the Fed kind of come to the rescue, do they take a bitter pill now, or do they have kind of the Fed stay behind the curve and things become worse? So I did the corollary to Jimmy Carter, and Jimmy Carter's, you know, the Federal Reserve, his chair was very much behind the curve until Paul Volcker came in and shot up interest rates, but that was in the year before his reelection. And so the hope for Democrats, again, it's not for 2022. I think it's very hard for them to come back, but it's just to take a bitter pill now to try to bring down inflation, raise rates, and that may include a bumpy landing, and that may include some stagflation, but doing it in 2022 or early 2023 can maybe kind of harken back to President Ronald Reagan when he was facing with this high inflation and then also a recession as well. But the rates with Paul Volcker doing raising rates in 1980 and 1981 kind of led to a booming economy that led to kind of the Morning in America campaign for Reagan in 1984 for his reelection. And so I think that's the hope that Democrats will have in kind of trying to deal with a potential stagflation.
Sounds good. Thanks, Ben. So Melissa, you're in a very interesting state for this coming election. You're in Ohio. The Senate race there is quite interesting with J.D. Vance on the Republican side, Tim Ryan on the Democratic side. Thinking specifically, but not exclusively, about the economy, what are some of the arguments that you're hearing there? What are they saying to voters? And do you think that race is representative of a bigger narrative this season?
So they both are focused not quite overseas. I guess in the case of Tim Ryan, the Democrat, it's all about China. And J.D. Vance, for the Republican, it's all about Mexico. It's all about that Mexican border. Let me start with Tim Ryan. He's a Democrat in the lines of Sherrod Brown, very much about the working class and raising the working class. His focus has been China. In fact, one of his first ads during the primary, it said China like a dozen times in the ad, and really said it's us versus China. And his focus, his advertising is all about bringing manufacturing jobs back to Ohio. So he's all about manufacturing jobs, bringing them back to Ohio, and seeing China as the bad guy here. J.D. Vance, on the other hand, he's really running an America First campaign in the manner of Donald Trump, who endorsed him and boosted him from third or fourth place to first place in winning that nomination. He's focused a little less on jobs, although he says it's important to bring jobs back to Ohio. He's focusing more on immigrants at the Mexican border, illegal immigrants getting into this country, drugs getting into this country. He's really veering toward an emphasis on building the wall more than on speaking directly to pocketbook issues like jobs, bringing manufacturing jobs here. What neither candidate is really talking about, which surprises me, is inflation. To me, that is going to be the big issue heading into November. Now, this race has just left the primary stage, so they've got some months. J.D. Vance is doing a lot of fundraising right now because he had a very contested primary to get through. So we'll see what they have to say. One thing I will say that I think is a warning, not just to J.D. Vance, but to Republicans, they're going to be tempted to run on cultural issues, to run on issues like building the wall, critical race theory, transgender bathrooms, transgender kids in sports, stuff like that. I think it's a mistake based on what we know about what really drives vote choice. While running on those kinds of cultural issues can appeal to the base, they don't need to worry about the base. They need to win the independent voters in the middle. And I think it's going to be those pocketbook issues that do it.
I see. Thank you, Melissa. Ben, let's assume that Republicans take both the House and Senate in November. So Senator Rick Scott of Florida, who heads the Senate campaign arm of the GOP, he's authored a very widely discussed proposal. It would impose a tax increase on many Americans. It also opens the door for cutting Social Security and Medicare. Is this the kind of thing that we can expect if the GOP dominates Congress next year?
Yeah, I'd say Senator Rick Scott is speaking for Rick Scott, someone angling to be the third or fourth most likely Floridian to win the GOP presidential nomination in 2024. I'd say his position on entitlements is just not part of mainstream Republicanism or something to expect if they take back control of Congress. If they do take back, I mean, there's limited partisan policies Republicans can pass that Biden won't veto. And beyond the traditional oversight and hearing risks that will occur, there are two things that I'm looking at, the traditional GOP and the new GOP. I'd say in the traditional GOP, it's defending or extending their top legislative victory this past decade in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So several provisions have or are about to expire, interest deductibility, 100% bonus depreciation, and all the individual and pass-through provisions expire at the end of 2025. And so Republicans certainly will try to find ways to extend these provisions, and maybe there's some bipartisan agreement for extension that includes Democratic priorities like low-income housing tax credits or even the child tax credit. But for the new GOP, it's a more kind of Trumpian one. It's spearheaded in the House, which is often kind of the forefront of policy. And so the campaign platform of today usually becomes the policy platform of tomorrow. And that platform becomes actual law when Republicans next have unified control of government, perhaps as soon as 2025. And so it really does bear watching, like, what are House Republicans proposing for these midterm elections? And so Kevin McCarthy, who's the aspiring speaker, is taking a cue from former Speaker Newt Gingrich in developing a campaign platform called Commitment to America. And so there are several areas of focus for this. It's taking on China, taking on big tech, pushing deregulations, promoting American energy, and even some climate solutions, and then taking on so-called wokeness, whether in schools, regulations, regulators, or corporations. And so in a less politically polarized world, there's some actual overlap between Republicans and Democrats here, but I wouldn't be surprised if items like wokeness, fossil fuels, and conservative bias on social media grab more attention. So it's just something we'll have to see. What's the relationship between Republicans and Joe Biden? Is it acrimonious mostly, or is there some room for collaboration?
You know, Ben, Melissa, that actually gives me an opportunity to go back to a viewer question. There's lots of them coming in. And either of you can take a crack at this if you like. But Ben, this actually went to something that you just said. Ian asks, do you think once the Republicans become the majority in Congress, they'll pass legislation to increase oil and gas pipelines and permits. He says petroleum is a key component of inflation, which I think is a truism. So is that something, Ben, I would ask you that you see? And Melissa, can you talk about how gas prices are playing a role here in voters' thinking?
Without a doubt. I think it's it's passing legislation in the House. It's also going against some of the regulatory policies that the Biden administration are trying to promulgate. So let's the climate disclosure from the SEC. There's a lot of pushback by Republicans. And so whether that's using the Congressional Review Act to try to overturn it, or just holding a lot of hearings. It just, the question though, is that there is room for collaboration for like energy independence. It's just like, just as Democrats, when they hold control, they're not really looking to work with Republicans. It's more about messaging. And with Republicans, it's more about kind of providing a contrast with Biden, and kind of we'll see where kind of the gas prices are come next year. But is there room for doing changes in kind of the permitting process in exchange for maybe some more clean energy tax incentives or something like that? And that's always kind of the challenge in when both sides want to do something, which is kind of promoting domestic energy in America, but kind of the ends is not quite the same. And so is there someone like a Senator Joe Manchin or a Senator Lisa Murkowski who are willing to kind of bridge the divide, or is there just a bridge too far in terms of coming to an agreement on energy policy when it's such a political hot potato?
Melissa, what do you think? Is talk about bringing energy prices down music to voters' ears?
I think it's music to voters' ears, but until they actually see the price coming down at the pump, it's just noise. And I do think that unless gas prices come down, which in part has to do with domestic policy, but also in part has to do with the war in Ukraine, which is outside of the control of the Democrats and the Republicans. The other thing that's complicating is that this is summer travel season. And so here we have this surge in gas prices that's coinciding with people wanting to get in their cars. There are many people who didn't take the kinds of vacations they wanted to take in the last 2 years. We saw a little bit more vacation travel last summer, certainly, than summer 2020. I would expect we'd even see more, but for the price of gas. So it's really kind of a lethal combination of factors that are just not good politically for the party in power. This gives me the opportunity to say that, you know, one of the issues for the Democrats is they control both the House, the Senate, and the White House. And so it's one of those periods of unified government where whether or not, Joe Biden, for instance, can really do much about the inflation rate, as Ben has pointed out, that's really more of a Fed issue. Voters will blame the party in power, and the Democrats clearly hold power right now with all three in control.
I'd like to plug a piece on this exact subject by my colleague, Vic Rakolaitis, who I believe has talked to both of you on occasion. He wrote a good piece for Market Watch on exactly this topic about what presidents can and can't do on inflation and how the Fed is more, of course, in the driver's seat. Let me ask Melissa a stock market question. On Friday, the S&P 500 briefly dipped into a bear market. Stocks are down again today. Would it behoove either party, you think, to make this issue part of their campaigns? Earlier this month, Congressman Jim Jordan, who's an Ohio Republican, he tweeted that, quote, "Your 401k misses President Trump," end quote. Is this sort of thing something that you think we can hear more of, with the market sliding or not?
I do think that Jim Jordan and other Republicans will make a campaign issue of this, and I think it will resonate among some of the middle class and certainly all upper middle class voters, but not everybody has a 401k. So I think in combination with talking about the stock market struggles, addressing inflation with every voter, in combination with that, that will also resonate with everybody. A point I made earlier is that I think the temptation for Republicans will be to fight the culture wars. And I think, there's a real pull to do that because the Trump base of the Republican Party is the most enthusiastic and energized base, portion of the Republican Party, and they respond really well to culture issues. But to win in November, I think that both parties need to reach out. What I'd say to the Democrats is that they will have to speak to inflation. They can't ignore it. They are the party in power, as I said before. And I think the kinds of any kinds of tangible progress that the Democrats can make can only help. As Ben said, however, though, it could be that they've got to take a bitter pill now, and it could be not until 2024. That Democrats stand to gain from any steps that are taken now.
Ben, let me put that same question to you. I mean, do you think that stock market going down as much as it has, is this going to be a factor going into the election in November?
Just as a reference, I think President Trump, he believed a good market makes a good presidency. President Biden believes a good presidency makes a good market. Mm-hmm. And I think Biden's view is more typical of presidents who understand kind of the relative futility of chasing the market. It's certainly a talking point for Republicans to employ. And I think it does have some legs, especially with kind of retirements. But, you know, a 401k is not necessarily something people see front in mind every day. But I don't expect the Democrats to take the bait. I mean, you even see some progressive regulators or lawmakers, they even have kind of schadenfreude at a declining market. Just the focus is more on bolstering labor and consumers and not capital. I mean, Democrats are even kind of moving forward with a 1% corporate buyback tax and reconciliation. So I don't see this as something that, you know, Democrats are looking to engage in, and maybe Republicans make a point, but it's just not top of mind. And I think there's a paradigm shift just from even a couple of years ago when there was a real desire to kind of have a bailout to the markets from both Congress and the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm. We're getting a little bit close to the end here, but I do have a few more questions for both of you too. Melissa, let's fast forward to election night. Do you think what are some of the key races that you're going to be watching to determine control? And are we going to have an early night, so to speak, about knowing who's going to be in charge?
Well, I think you might as well start brewing the coffee now because you'll need a lot of it. I think it will be a long night. On the Senate side, there are about five, just a handful of toss-up Senate races. And these are considered toss-ups both because of the polling being so close, the polling that we have now, as well, these are states that Biden won very narrowly and in several cases flipped from the Republican to the Democratic column. So I'll be watching that Pennsylvania Senate race between Democratic John Fetterman and a yet to be determined Republican. That looks like it's going to a recount in Pennsylvania. That's a state that Biden won by just a point. The Senate race in Georgia, there we have a primary today in the state of Georgia. That's a state that Biden flipped. He won it by less than a percentage point. Same goes with Arizona. Mark Kelly, the Democrat, is the incumbent. Up for re-election. Nevada, there's a Democrat, Catherine Cortez Masto, who's now considered to be in a toss-up. So Wisconsin, we've got Republican Ron Johnson apparently at risk. So there are the five Senate races to watch in those five states. There are about 30 toss-up states in the House. I will not bore listeners with going through them, but I'll tell you of one interesting one that's here in my backyard. That's the 9th Congressional District in Ohio. The longest-serving woman in the U.S. House of Representatives is Marcy Kaptur. She's going to try to defend that seat. The Republicans nominated a candidate who's never run for office before, J.R. Majewski. He attended the Stop the Steal rally on January 6th. And he's perhaps best known for spray painting a giant portrait of Donald Trump in his backyard on the lawn that you could see from drones in the air. I will be watching that one. What's interesting there that you might look at some of these other toss-up House races is where the GOP nominated a real Trump-aligned, untested candidate, so not a mainstream GOP candidate. How well do those candidates do amongst a general electorate? It remains to be seen.
Okay. Just real quickly for both of you, if you have one or two quick comments about, do you see any surprises coming up that could buoy Democrats' chances in the fall or somehow change the equation? I mean, is there a sort of not October surprise, of course, but November surprise? Let's say if Russia ends the war in Ukraine, inflation goes down, or something like that. Any surprises? Ben, you first, and then Melissa.
Yeah, I just say, I don't think Democrats can win the midterms, but Republicans can lose them. And that's particularly in the Senate. So that comes down to candidate quality. So will Herschel Walker, the presumptive GOP nominee in Georgia, stand up to increased scrutiny? And the same goes for like Dr. Oz in Pennsylvania. And there's questions about who the Republicans nominate in Arizona and New Hampshire. And when the elections are a referendum on the national environment, Republicans win. But when it's a choice between a mainstream Democrat and a controversial Republican, it becomes more competitive. So that's something I'm watching.
Great. Melissa?
Believe it or not, I'm going to look for that June or July surprise. It's not really a surprise. We know it's coming. The Supreme Court will, all indicators suggest, will be overturning Roe versus Wade. I expect to see tens of thousands of people protest that decision when it becomes final. And the big question then is, can Democrats capitalize on that and really use the energy dismissal, the elimination of the right to abortion is definitely going to engender. Can Democrats really harness it and organize around it and make a difference in terms of their prospects in November?
Thank you, Melissa. And Melissa, Ben, thank you both very much. It's been a fantastic conversation. This is all the time we have for today. I want to thank the audience too for tuning in. And before I go, I would like to remind viewers to tune in for our next episode tomorrow, which is going to be on annuities and retirement. MarketWatch's retirement reporter Alessandra Melito and Michael Fink, who is with the Alliance for Lifetime Income, are going to talk about when annuities are appropriate and why they might be misunderstood and how to find the right one. But for today, I want to again thank my guests, Ben and Melissa, and thank you all for listening. Have a good day, everybody.
The Claude 3 model family by Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. Haiku is lightning fast and cost effective. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Learn more at anthropic.com/Claude.